continuing with Birds of Prey by Wilbur Smith. There was only one more word written on the paper. Althuda, with a question mark. Howell puzzled over this until he understood that Abberley, or the writer, must be asking after the welfare of the other prisoner. Althuda, he called softly. Are you awake? Greetings, Howell. What cheer? Somebody outside asks after you. There was a long silence as Althuda considered this. Who asks? I know not. Howell could not explain, for he was certain that the jailers eavesdropped on these exchanges. Another long silence. I can guess, Althuda called, and so can you. We have discussed her before. Can you send a reply? Tell her I am alive. Howell rubbed the charcoal on the wall to sharpen a point on it and wrote, Althuda well. Even though his letters were small and cramped, there was space for no more on the paper. The following morning, as they were led out to begin the day's work on the scaffold, Daniel screened Howell for the moment he needed to push the scrap of paper into the same crack from which he had retrieved it. In the middle of the morning, Abberley drove the governor down from the residence and parked once more beneath the staircase. Long after Van der Velde had disappeared into his sanctum, Abberley remained on the coachman's seat. At last, looked up casually at a flock of red-winged starlings that had come down from the cliffs to perch on the walls of the eastern bastion and give vent to their low, mournful whistles. From the birds, his eye passed over Howell, who nodded. Once again, Abberley dismounted and tended his horses, pausing beside the wall to adjust the straps on his boots, and with a magician's sleight of hand to recover the message from the crack in the wall. Howell breathed easier when he saw it, for they had established their letterbox. They did not make the mistake of trying to exchange messages every day. Sometimes a week or more might pass before Abberley nodded at Howell and placed a note in the wall. If Howell had a message, he would give the same signal, and Abberley would leave paper and charcoal for him. The second message Howell received was in that artistic and delicate script. A is safe. Orchid sends her heart. Is the orchid the one we spoke of? Howell called to Althuda that night. She sends you her heart and says you are safe. I do not know how she has achieved that, but I must believe it and be thankful to her in this, as in so many things. There was a lift of relief in Althuda's tone. Howell held the scrap of paper to his nose and fancied that he detected the faintest perfume upon it. He huddled on his damp straw in a corner of the cell. He thought about Sukina until sleep overcame him. The memory of her beauty was like a candle flame in the winter darkness of the dungeon. Governor van der Velde was passing drunk. He had swilled the Rhenish with the soup, and Madeira with the fish and the lobster. The red wines of Burgundy had accompanied the mutton stew and the pigeon pie. He had quaffed the claret with the beef, and interspersed each with draughts of good Dutch gin. When at last he rose from the board, he steadied himself as he wove to his seat by the fire with a hand on his wife's arm. She was not usually so attentive, but all this evening she had been in an affectionate and merry mood, laughing at his sallies, which on other occasions she would have ignored, and refilling his glass with her own precious hand before it was half emptied. Come to think of it, he could not remember when last they had dined alone, just the two of them, like a pair of lovers. For once he had not been forced to put up with the company of the rustic yokels from the settlement, or with the obsequious flattery of ambitious company servants, or, greatest blessing of all, without the posturing and boasting of that amorous prig Schroeder. He fell back in the deep leather chair beside the fire, and Sukina brought him a box of good Dutch cigars to choose from. As she held the burning taper for him, he peered with a lascivious eye down the front of her costume. The soft swell of girlish breasts, between which nestled the exotic jade brooch, moved him so that he felt his groin swell and engorge pleasantly. Katinka was kneeling at the open hearth, but she regarded him so slyly that he worried for a moment that she had seen him ogle the slave girl's bosom. But then she smiled and took up the poker that was heating in the fire and plunged its glowing tip into the stone jug of scented wine. It boiled and fumed, and she filled a bowl of it and brought it to him before it had time to cool. My beautiful wife, he slurred a little. My little darling. He toasted her with the steaming bowl. He was not yet so intoxicated or gullible that he did not realize there would be some price to pay for this unusual kindness. There always was. Kneeling in front of him, Katinka looked up at Tsukina, who hovered close at hand. "That is all for tonight, Tsukina. You may go." She gave the slave girl a knowing smile. "I wish you sweet sleep and dreams of paradise, master and mistress." Tsukina gave that graceful genuflection and glided from the room. She slid the carved oriental screen door closed behind her and knelt there quietly with her face close to the panel. These were her mistress's orders. Katinka wanted Tsukina to witness what transpired between her and her husband. She knew that it would tighten the knot that bound the slave girl to her. Now Katinka moved behind her husband's chair. "You have had such a difficult week," she said softly. "What with the affair of the pirate's body being stolen from the scaffold, and now the new census and taxation ordinances from the Seventeen. My poor darling husband, let me massage your shoulders for you." She removed his wig and kissed the top of his head. The stubble prickled her lips, and she stood back and dug her thumbs into his heavy shoulders. Van der Velde sighed with pleasure, not only with the sensation of the knots being eased from his muscles, but because he recognized this as the prelude to the infrequent dispensation of her sexual favors. "How much do you love me?" she asked, and leaned over him to nibble at his ear. "I adore you," he blurted out. "I worship you. You are always so kind to me." Her voice took on that husky quality that made his skin tingle. "I want to be kind to you. I have written to my father. I have explained to him the circumstances of the pirate's demise, and how it was not your fault that it happened. I shall give the letter to the captain of the homeward-bound galleon, which is anchored in the bay at the moment, to hand to Papa in person." "May I see the letter before you dispatch it?" he asked warily. "It would carry much weight if it could accompany my own report to the Seventeen, which I shall send on the same ship." "Of course you may. I shall bring it to you before you leave for the castle in the morning." She brushed the top of his head with her lips again, and slid her fingers from his shoulders down over his chest. She unhooked the buttons of his doublet and slipped both hands into the opening. She took a handful of each of his pendulous dugs and kneaded them as though they were lumps of soft bread dough. "You are such a good little wife," he said. "I would like to give you a sign of my love. What do you lack? A jewel? A pet? A new slave? Tell your old Petrus." "I do have a little whimsy," she admitted coyly. "There is a man in the dungeons."
"One of the pirates?" she hazarded.
"No, a slave named Althuda."
"Oh yes, I know about him. The rebel runaway. I shall deal with him this coming week. His death warrant is already on my desk waiting for his signature. Shall I give him to Stara Kayan? Would you like to watch? Is that it? You want to enjoy the sport? How can I deny you?"
She reached down and began to unlace the fastening of his breeches. He spread his legs and lay back comfortably in the chair to make the task easier for her.
"I want you to grant Althuda a reprieve," she whispered in his ear.
He sat bolt upright.
"You are mad," she gasped.
"You are so cruel to call me mad," she pouted.
But he is a runaway. He and his gang of thugs murdered 20 of the soldiers who were sent to recapture him. I could never free him."
"I know you cannot release him, but I want you to keep him alive. You could set him to work on the walls of your castle."
"I cannot do it," he shook his shaven head. "Not even for you."
She came round from behind his chair and knelt in front of him. Her fingers began work again on the lacing of his breeches. He tried to sit up, but she pushed him back and reached inside. "All the saints bear witness, the old sodomite makes it difficult for me. He is as soft and white as unrisen dough," she thought as she grasped him.
"Not even for your own loving wife," she whispered,
and looked up with swimming violet eyes as she thought, That's a little better. I felt the drooping lily twitch.
I mean, rather, thought it would be difficult.
He was in a quandary.
I understand, she murmured.
It was just as difficult for me to compose my letter to my father. I would hate to be forced to burn it.
She stood up and lifted her skirts as though she were about to climb over a stile. She was naked from the waist down, and his eyes bulged like those of a cod hauled up abruptly from deep water. He struggled to sit up and at the same time tried to reach for her.
I'll not have you on top of me again, you great tub of pork lard, she thought, as she smiled lovingly at him and held him down with both hands on his shoulders. Last time you nearly squashed the life out of me.
She straddled him as though she were mounting the mare.
Oh, sweet Jesus, what a mighty man you are, she cried as she took him in.
The only pleasure she received from it was the thought of Sukina listening at the screen door. She closed her eyes and summoned up the image of the slave girl's slim thighs and the treasure that lay between them. The thought inflamed her, and she knew that her husband would feel her flowing response and think it was for him alone.
Katinka,
he gurgled and snorted as though he were drowning.
I love you.
De reprieve? She asked.
I cannot do it.
Then neither can I,
she said, and lifted herself onto her knees. She had to fight to keep herself from laughing aloud as she watched his face swell and his eyes bulge further out. He wriggled and heaved under her, thrusting vainly at the air.
Please,
he whimpered.
Please?
De reprieve?
She asked, keeping herself suspended tantalizingly above him.
Yeah,
he whinnied.
Anything. I will give you anything you want. I love you, my husband.
She whispered in his ear, and sank down like a bird settling on its nest. Last time he lasted to count 100, she remembered. This time I shall try to bring him to the finishing line in under 50. With rocking hips, she set herself to better her own record. Mancia opened the door of Althuda's cell and roared,
Come out, you murderous dog! Governor's orders! You go to work on the wall!
Althuda stepped out through the iron door, and Mancia glared at him.
Seems you'll not be dancing a quadrille on the scaffold with Star Chayan, more's the pity. But don't crow too loud, you'll give us as much sport on the castle walls. Barnard and his hounds will see to that. You'll not last the winter out, I'll wager 100 guilders on it.
Hal led the file of convicts up from the lower cells, and paused on the stone step below Althuda. For a long moment they studied each other keenly. Both looked pleased at what they saw. "If you give me a choice, then I think I prefer the cut of your sister's jib to yours," Al smiled. Alsuda was smaller in stature than his voice had suggested, and all the marks of his long captivity were plain to see. His skin was sallow, and his hair matted and tangled, but the body that showed through the holes in his miserable rags was neat and strong and supple. His gaze was frank, and his countenance comely and open. Although his eyes were almond-shaped, and his hair straight and black, his English blood mingled well with that of his mother's people. There was a proud and stubborn set to his jaw.
"What cradle did you fall out of?" he asked Hal with a grin.
It was obvious that he was overjoyed to come out from the shadow of the gallows.
"I called for a man, and they sent a boy." "Come on, you murdering renegade!"
Barnard bellowed, as the jailer handed over the convicts to his charge.
"You may have escaped the noose for the moment, but I have a few pleasures in store for you. You slit the throats of some of my comrades on the mountainside."
It was clear that all the garrison bitterly resented Althuda's reprieve. Then Barnard turned on Hal.
"As for you, you stinking pirate, your tongue is too loose by far. One word out of you today, and I'll kick you off the wall and feed the scraps to my dogs."
Barnard separated the two of them. He sent Hal back onto the scaffold and set Althuda to work in the gangs of convicts down in the courtyard, unloading the masonry blocks from the ox-drawn wagons as they came down from the quarries. However, that evening Althuda was herded into the general cell. Daniel and the rest crowded around him in the darkness to hear his story told in detail and to ply him with all the questions that they had not been able to shout up the staircase. He was something new in the dreary, monotonous round of captivity and heartbreaking labour. only when the kettle of stew was brought down from the kitchens and the men hurried to their frugal dinner did Hal have a chance to speak to him alone.
If you escape once before, Althuda, then there must be a chance we can do it again.
I was in a better state then. I had my own fishing boat. My master trusted me, and I had the run of the colony. How can we escape from the walls that surround us? I fear it would be impossible.
You use the words fear and impossible. That is not a language that I understand.
I thought perhaps I had met a man, not some faint heart.
Keep the harsh words for our enemies, my friend, Althuda returned his hard stare. Instead of telling me what a hero you are, tell me instead now how you receive word from the outside.
Hal's stern expression cracked, and he grinned at him. He liked the man's spirit, the way he could meet broadside with broadside. He moved closer and lowered his voice as he explained to Althuda how it was done. Then he handed him the latest message he'd received. Althuda took it to the grill gate and studied it in the torchlight that filtered down the staircase.
Yes, he said, that is my sister's hand. I know of no other who can pen her letters so prettily.
That evening the two composed a message for Aberley to collect, to let him and Sukina know that Althuda had been released from Skellum's den. However, it seemed that Sukina already knew this, for the following day she accompanied her mistress on a visit to the castle. She rode beside Aberley on the driver's seat of the carriage. At the staircase she helped her mistress dismount. It was strange, but Hal was by now so accustomed to Katinka's visits that he no longer felt angry and bitter when he looked upon her angelic face. She held his attention barely at all, and instead he watched the slave girl. Sukina stood at the bottom of the staircase and darted quick bird-like glances in every direction as she searched for her brother's face among the gangs of convicts. Althuda was working in the courtyard, chipping and chiselling the rough stone blocks into shape before they were swung up on the gantry to the top of the unfinished walls. His face and hair were powdered white as a miller's with the stone dust, and his hands were bleeding from the abrasion of tools and rough stone. At last Sukina picked him out, and brother and sister stared at each other for one long, ecstatic moment. Sukina's radiant expression was one of the most beautiful Hal had ever looked upon, but it was only for a fleeting instant. Then Sukina hurried up the stairs after her mistress. A short time later they reappeared at the head of the staircase. But Governor van der Velde was with them. He had his wife on his arm, and Sukina followed them demurely. The slave girl seemed to be searching for someone other than her brother. When she mounted the driver's seat of the carriage, she murmured something to Aberley. In response, Aberley moved only his eyes, but she followed his gaze, up to the top of the scaffold, where Hal was belaying a rope end. He felt his pulse sprint as he realized that it was him she was seeking. They stared at each other solemnly, and it seemed they were very close, for afterwards Hal could remember every angle and plane of her face and the graceful curve of her neck. At last she smiled. It was a brief, honeyed interlude, then dropped her eyes. That night in his cell he lay on the clammy straw and relived the moment. Perhaps she will come again tomorrow, he thought, as sleep swept over him like a black wave. But she did not come again for many weeks.